From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Free trade has taken a hit in recent public policy debates. During a visit to North Carolina, a Heritage Foundation expert shared his thoughts about current challenges involving trade. There's a popular statistic in debates about public schools. It's per pupil expenditure. You'll hear from one North Carolina lawmaker who labels that statistic misleading. North Carolina's state law is designed to help the public get access to government documents. An expert with multiple public records requests offers ideas for improving that law. And we'll assess two recent reports that highlight negative impacts from North Carolina's job licensing restrictions. They block people in low-income jobs and those with criminal records. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
It is a shocking fact. North Carolina is home to four of the 25 worst cities in the U.S. for opioid abuse. But government won't solve the opioid crisis. That is the headline on the front page of the December issue of Carolina Journal. Associate editor Carrie Travis goes in depth on the abuse of painkillers that has swept North Carolina just as it has the entire country. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. He joins us now to go over some of this data. Rick, welcome back.
Thank you, Donna.
I wish it was on a happier subject, but this is pretty serious. In fact, President Trump recently described the opioid situation in our country as a national emergency.
Right. There are many, many causes for the current surge in opioid abuse around the country, and a lot of this has to do with problems of pain management and actual overreaction by some regulatory officials to issues of people who do have chronic pain. They may have autoimmune diseases that cause them chronic pain, and the best form of treatment is an opioid. And we're talking about, in that case, what is an opioid? We don't mean heroin, for instance. What we're talking about are drugs like Percocet, Vicodin, frequently prescribed basically opiate-based painkilling medications that do come with physical dependency. And so because of that, people who may have chronic issues with pain are prescribed that, or people who have surgeries and are rehabilitating are prescribed these medications. And sometimes they become dependent upon them. And in other cases, the doctors, to follow various various regulations by the federal government, aren't allowed to prescribe enough. And so therefore, when the person is still suffering from pain, the person goes to off-label uses, if you will, may go to street drugs. And that's what is causing a lot of the problems and causing the deaths and the frequent illnesses and people who are just basically out of society because they can no longer function properly without these medications.
And thus the headline on the December issue of Carolina Journal, government won't solve this opioid crisis.
Right, exactly. The notion that's been taken in the past, this started back in the 1990s with the idea that we're going to move toward a different form of pain management, and that we're going to start prescribing these particular medications very heavily because, unlike, let's say, morphine or heroin, they were safer in some ways. You could prescribe lower doses and get the same amount of impact. Now, these medications quite often are combined with Tylenol, with acetaminophen, and that causes all sorts of issues potentially with liver and kidney damage. And so that was one area that was causing problems, is that people were taking these medications to deal with an actual medical condition, and then were having side effects because of the other additives that were there in the drugs. And so as a result, the federal government said, okay, we're just going to start prescribing less of them, or prescribing them less often, prescribing them in fewer or smaller doses. and they weren't doing the job. And so then we have another unintended consequence of an attempt to make the situation safer. We've actually, in some cases, made it much more difficult for those people who do have pain to be managed and who somehow or another need relief.
The four cities that we mentioned, Rick, at the top of this interview, Wilmington, Hickory, Jacksonville, and Fayetteville, North Carolina, four North Carolina cities on this top 25 list for cities that have a serious problem with opioid abuse. Do we have any sense of what those four cities may have in common?
Well, three of the four are military cities. We have Wilmington, you have Jacksonville, and you have Fayetteville. And so you will quite often in military cities, you will have people who are have been deployed overseas, who have may have been in combat situations, who may be in stress situations, and who may then be prescribed these drugs actual recovery from being wounded or from having other pain related to their military service. Hickory, I'm not exactly sure what the case may be, but it is formerly a relatively successful textile and industrial town that has come upon harder times, and so we find in areas all across Appalachia and all across the Rust Belt also in the country, you find cities that were once, if not thriving, at least very vibrant industrial cities that have seen their economies go south because of changes in technology and the like. And so people sometimes just turn to drugs as an escape from that.
Yeah, sadly, that's the case. That sometimes does happen. Now, one of the reasons that Carolina Journal has chosen to report so extensively on this issue, Rick, is because the State General Assembly has now taken notice of this and gotten involved. Let's talk about a couple of things that are going on there. First of all, something called the STOP Act set to take effect on January 1st.
Right. This is an attempt to monitor and keep a better handle on the actual prescribing of medications of opioids for pain management. This is something that has not always gotten favorable reviews from people in the medical community, for instance, who think that it may well be too restrictive in the way that it handles the issue of prescribing pain medicine. But it is, again, it's a very conscious effort by the state to get involved in this situation.
Then we also have Representative Greg Murphy out of Pitt County. He wants to look at criminal justice reforms.
Right.
What's the issue there?
Greg Murphy's a physician, for one thing. He's an MD. And what he would like to do is to look at ways the criminal justice system deals with people who are involved in taking drugs illegally. In this case, we're talking about drugs that might be prescribed, but that were taken off prescription, were taken for uses for which they were not intended, and how the criminal justice system quite often has just tended to warehouse people. And this is a way to almost ensure that someone who has a dependency or addiction problem doesn't get rid of that dependency or addiction problem, because there are drug courts in various jurisdictions in this state and elsewhere, and they treat, much like the juvenile system treats adult offenders differently, the drug courts treat drug offenders differently than it might treat your breaking and entering or your armed robbery convict or whatever. There's access to counseling, there's access to drug treatment. The judges involved get personally involved quite often in the lives of the people who come through their courts, and so they do things. They offer mentoring. They do all sorts of things to actively intervene in these people's lives and to help them figure out ways to get away from the psychological dependency, even if they may still have some physical need to take these drugs.
In addition to the General Assembly getting involved to address this issue, we have Governor Roy Cooper. He's one of just a handful of governors. I think it's just three sitting governors who are involved with the Trump administration work on this.
Right. The president has set up his own commission to look into this issue, and Governor Cooper is one of the three governors on this. And it also is a good fit in many ways because he was Attorney General of North Carolina for 16 years beforehand. And so North Carolina is perceived as a very important state for statistical reasons, obviously, but also because of our experience with this and the experience of our elected officials there, too. I mean, there are a lot of different angles that we're going to go after here. And North Carolina, fortunately, is somebody taking the lead in this issue.
And Carolina Journal has devoted its cover story of the December issue to this challenge with the opioid crisis in North Carolina. You can read it at carolinajournal.com and, of course, pick up the print edition. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. Thank you, Rick.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Trade plays an important role in the American economy and in North Carolina's economy. Just how important? Our next guest will help us answer that question. Brian Riley is the J. Van Andel Senior Policy Analyst in Trade Policy at the Center for International Trade and Economics at the Heritage Foundation. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here at John Locke today.
The trade we've talked about for a number of years being important to the American economy and the North Carolina economy, you've actually taken a look at some of the details of just how important it is. What should people know?
Well, every year at Heritage, we produce a report called the Index of Economic Freedom, where we rank about 180 countries around the world, look at their policies, compare them to U.S. policies. And I think a lot of people probably won't be surprised to learn that countries that are more open, they have more freedom or more prosperous than those that are closed. And I think one famous example of that is if you look at a map of the Korean Peninsula at night and you can just see the line, South Korea is all lit up and North Korea, there's nothing there. So I think a lot of people here in the United States instinctively understand more freedom is a good thing. That's what we were founded on. Well, it turns out the same goes for trade policies. Countries that are more open to international trade and investment are more prosperous. And it's a little bit more controversial to talk about trade policy sometimes than just the big picture economic freedom. But if you look at a state like North Carolina, since 1994, when the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, took effect, the state's added about 50% to its manufacturing output. Its economy's 2.5 times bigger. You've added about 1 million new jobs. Now, are those all because of NAFTA? No, of course not. But kind of the world President Reagan envisioned back in the 80s, where there are few barriers to international trade and investment, creating opportunities here in the United States and creating stronger economies around the world so we have more export markets. That's kind of the direction that I think we need to continue to move.
Now, some people are going to hear us and say, wait a minute, ever since NAFTA came in, we've heard about textile mills closing down. Ross Perot was right about the giant sucking sound of jobs to Mexico. What's the response to people who think that that free trade's not all it's cracked up to be?
Well, there's a grand truth to that. Let's face it, North Carolina doesn't have as many textile and apparel jobs as it did in 1993. It doesn't have as many furniture jobs as it did in 1993. Now, does that mean we want to turn back the clock to 93 and try and get those jobs back? I think that would really be a mistake. The benefits of trade are really similar to the benefits of new technologies. We can complain about the lost furniture jobs. We can complain about the lost blockbuster jobs because nobody rents videos anymore. They download it or stream it. And I think it's a real big mistake to focus on one particular sector of the economy. Let's look overall what's going on. Overall, the state has hundreds of thousands of jobs that depend on exports, many, many more jobs today depend on foreign investment that creates jobs for people here in North Carolina than jobs in the furniture or textile and apparel industries. We do need to have good policies from Washington, D.C. that makes it easy for people to find new jobs and easy for new industries to be created. I think that's what we need to encourage and not blame trade for problems that a lot of times are a result of economic problems in the created by politicians. But I really think it's important to emphasize the fact that with trade and new technology, there are winners and losers. How can we have an environment that allows for the creation of more winners and bigger winners so that overall everybody's better off?
That is the voice of Brian Riley, who is a senior policy analyst at the Heritage Foundation. You mentioned an interesting word, winners, which is a word that our president likes to use quite a bit. But President Trump has not always been a fan, at least on the campaign trail and in his spoken remarks, of free trade. Is this something that has been an impediment to making the case for free trade, the fact that the White House has not always been as vocal for free trade?
Well, the president of the United States has the bully pulpit, and people hear what he has to say. And increasingly in the Republican Party, more Republicans are skeptical of free trade than they were before President Trump came onto the scenes. I think that's because it's an issue where in many cases people don't have strong opinions. I'm a Republican. Republican president says it's bad. Well, it must be bad. So part of what we do at the Heritage Foundation is try and educate people about the economic facts so that they can make up their own minds. I think the positives from the Trump administration are twofold. First of all, their goal is to have a stronger, faster-growing economy that creates jobs. And to me, protectionist trade barriers that would restrict our freedom would undermine that goal. And I hope they understand this. And also, behind the rhetoric a lot of times is a focus on opening foreign markets to U.S. exports. Oh, it's not fair is the rhetoric. And in many cases, they're right. Foreign countries do have barriers to our exports. So if the focus is how can we encourage other countries to embrace economic freedom so we have more exports and more opportunities, I think that's constructive. The idea that trade is bad and we're losing, I certainly disagree with that. Trade by definition consists of millions of mutually beneficial transactions, win-win transactions. It's not a win-lose like some people seem to think.
When you have a chance to chat with people and share this type of information, do you find that most people, once they hear the facts, are willing to go along with the notion that free trade's good?
Well, most people are. There are just some facts that some of us in the policy community know and assume that everybody knows. For example, U.S. manufacturing output's never been higher. And they hear, well, we don't make anything anymore. It's simply not true. We make more than we ever have. Coming out of the recession in the 2000s, we certainly could do much better. But when you throw those numbers at them, and when you typically, if somebody has an example close to home, so I was just in Alabama last week, for example, and they had a Mercedes factory, Hyundai factory, Honda factory, and they understood the importance of having good policies to attract foreign investment, and were really concerned about the direction that we may be going with NAFTA negotiations. If those go south, they're concerned they might not get any more auto plants in the future. Or here in North Carolina, there's so many success stories of companies that have been able to export, or the huge amount of jobs, millions or hundreds of thousands of jobs that have been on foreign investment. And those are typically good jobs there. Not to take anything away from the furniture or textile and apparel industries, but the new jobs typically pay more than the old jobs. The catch is that a lot of times they need some training and education to equip people for those jobs. So that's part of the challenge that I think we face.
Well, in the brief time that we have remaining, do you think this is the type of issue that we're going to continue to need to have education about moving forward?
it's an ongoing issue. There are always special interests in D.C. who try and get special treatment. And all free trade is about is really not giving people special treatment, making it so that when people listen to this show, when you earn your paychecks, when I earn my paycheck, I get to decide how to spend my dollars, not somebody in D.C. based on who's got the best lobbyist. That's going to be an ongoing concern. I think the best way to address that is to have good trade agreements.
That is the voice of Brian Riley, a senior policy analyst at the Center for International Trade and Economics at the Heritage Foundation. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. In debates about school funding, one of the most common statistics is the amount of money spent per student. It's officially called per pupil expenditure, or PPE. Republican State Representative Craig Horn explained recently why that number bothers him.
Here in North Carolina, we are one of, and arguably the fastest growing state in the nation. Certainly one of the fastest growing states in the nation. Therefore, we have a lot of kids coming in. We need a lot of teachers. Teachers don't generally start at the top or even in the middle of the pay scale. New teachers, of course, start at the bottom of the pay scale. So if you have increasing number of teachers and increasing number of students and an increasing number of teachers at the lower end of the pay scale, your PPE, per pupil expenditure, is going to be lower, which does not necessarily at all mean that the quality of their education or that you're not meeting the needs of the student. As the teaching corps matures, the per pupil expenditure, same number of students even, same number of teachers, the PPE will go up. So I have a hard time personally using PPE as a benchmark of much of anything, quite frankly. Involved in PPE are the fixed costs of running your school. Well, if a school is built to hold 1,000 students and holds 700, your PPE is X. Just do the math. If your student population happens to go up to 800 or 1,000, your fixed costs are the same. Your PPE has gone down, but nothing's really changed with regard to quality.
During a recent meeting, Horn addressed these comments to an expert from a group called the Education Commission of the States. That expert's response: there is no magic number for per pupil expenditure, and the numbers can vary substantially from state to state. Horn responded,
maybe I'm being a little thin-skinned. As a policymaker, I hear about PPE all the time. I get beat up over PPE, and for the reasons that I talked about and you talked about, I'm generally resistant to what I think is an inordinate focus on PPE because of all the variables that you mentioned and the realities of us doing education.
That's Republican State Representative Craig Horn. He's one of the leaders of North Carolina's new Joint Legislative Task Force on Education Funding. Horn shared his frustration about an undue focus on just one statistic, per pupil expenditure. That's the average amount of money spent teaching each student in North Carolina schools. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we do. And that's not bluster. In a private survey of more than 250 North Carolina political insiders, 87% said we influence them either a great deal or a good amount. So while others talk and complain, we get to work providing research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day: jobs, health care, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse that is the envy of every other state. Our research has actually helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, and improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. The John Locke Foundation, we're dedicated to making North Carolina first in freedom. We're dedicated to you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina has a state law designed to ensure public access to government records, but our next guest says that law presents some problems. Elliot Engstrom is a fellow at the Elon University School of Law. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Before we get to the problems, remind people who are unfamiliar with it, what does North Carolina's public records law do?
So the public records law basically just gives the public access to government records. And by records, that means more than just paper. That means recordings, videos, computer files, emails, all sorts of stuff. So it's a really good way for people to just keep their government accountable to see what's going on in state government.
So we have this law. You have used this law. You have looked into this law. And you see that despite this great intent, that there are some issues and challenges. What are they?
There are. So one big issue that comes up is knowing who the custodian of a given record is. The public records law talks about custodians, and a custodian is basically just the person who has the record that you want. You would think that it'd be fairly simple to figure out who the custodian of a given record is, but it's not. And so, for example, a couple of years ago, there was a lawsuit over some emails at the Administrative Office of the Courts, and they were trying to figure out who is the custodian of an employee's emails. And the court found that both the plaintiffs and the defendants had named the wrong custodian. And these are people represented by – well, the plaintiff was a pro se lawyer, and then the defendant was lawyers from the attorney general's office. These are not dumb people, and they couldn't figure out who the custodian of the records was. This is important because if you don't sue the proper custodian, your lawsuit is dismissed. And so when you think about the pro se people bringing public records lawsuits, if lawyers at the Court of Appeals can't figure this out, how are pro se people just bringing these suits on their own supposed to figure this stuff out? And so there's a couple ways that I think we could make it more clear for people to know who to go after. One would be just to make agencies name their custodians like they name their process agents. If you're going to sue – you know, if you were going to sue the Department of Environmental Quality, for example, they have a process agent that you sue, that you serve process on. They could just name their custodian. Another way to do it would be to do what Florida has done and say that a custodian of records may delegate their duties to someone else. And I think that would fit really nicely into North Carolina's current system, because anyone who's dealt with public records laws at all knows that the people you really deal with are public information officers. You're not, if you're going after Governor Cooper's records, you don't deal with Governor Cooper. You deal with his public information officer. And so it makes more sense for that to be the person that you're fighting with in court, not actually Governor Cooper. And so that's just one of the areas. Another would be, for example, that in North Carolina, you have to actually have a public records request denied in order to bring a lawsuit. And this presents this big murky area of, well, what if my public records request has just been sitting there for 9 months? What can I do? At least one court has found that you can do nothing. There's nothing you can do in North Carolina. And I would think maybe there's a few things we could try, but at the moment there's no cause of action for delayed access to records. And so there's, again, different states we can look at. Florida and Ohio have both kind of dealt with this and said, if access is not provided to records in a reasonable amount of time, there's a cause of action for that. And this is not, by the way, trying to open the floodgates so the governments are just sued all the time by everybody, because we don't want that. That's not efficient. That's not a good use of taxpayer money for them to be defending frivolous lawsuits. But it is just a way for people to put a little more pressure on governments when you've requested records and after months and months and months, nothing's happened.
That is the voice of Elliot Engstrom. He is a fellow at the Elon University School of Law and has worked on these issues of public records and public records requests using North Carolina's law. You brought this up, and this is worth delving into more deeply, and that is this notion of people just flooding the government with public records requests, and don't we want to make sure that, that's not going to be happening if we change the laws? Do you think that the ideas that you put forward are ways to address the problem without opening the door to major unintended consequences?
Oh, absolutely. And so one of the goals that I look for in good public records laws is predictability and efficiency. And so, for example, if we don't know who the right custodian is, we might spend a year and a half litigating a case, then have it dismissed and have to start over. That's not a good use of taxpayer money. That's not a good use of government time. In terms of there being too many public records lawsuits, so in North Carolina, we amended our fee provision for plaintiffs in 2010. And then what you can do is you can look at statutes and see how much treatment have they received at the appellate courts. There has yet to be one case in North Carolina where it has been litigated, does this plaintiff deserve fees? So I definitely don't feel like we're near that danger point of having too many public records lawsuits. If anything, we don't have enough, because nobody really knows what it means to the fee provision says that a plaintiff gets attorney's fees if they substantially prevail. And that's another problem, is nobody knows what that means because it hasn't been litigated at all. What you could do is, if you're going to amend the public records law to say that there cannot be unreasonable delay, you can add in defenses for governments. So the government can say, well, I already have a bunch of public records requests that I'm dealing with. I have to deal with those before I can deal with yours. That would be a valid defense. Or this is going to take a lot of time. This is a very complicated request. All the government has to do is assert one of those defenses, and as long as it's reasonable, they're fine.
The ideas that you put forward sounds like they are really geared toward helping members of the public get more consistent access to these records or have a legal recourse if they aren't getting the access. But it also sounds as if, from what you're saying, this would help the government too, because it would say, this is what you have to do. You have to have a custodian named. You have to have a reasonably quick response, or at least have some good excuse why you don't.
Oh, yeah, because time and money are precious resources for governments. And if they're spending time and money litigating cases on things like who substantially prevails, who is the custodian, et cetera, that's a waste. Why can't we just say the custodian is this person, name them by statute? Like, for example, for a city, the custodian could be the mayor, right? The custodian could be a member of the city council, something like that. But I had a case recently where – or last year where I sued a city. I sued the city manager and the city itself, the entity, and the court ended up saying that the entity is the custodian of records, which doesn't make any sense. But I went with it because I just needed a defendant. But so all that time that we spent litigating who is the custodian could have just been dealt with via a statute. And I think that would just be a better way to go because that way governments don't have to think about this as something that needs to be litigated. It's just dealt with.
Do you get a sense that some people within the government would welcome this sort of clarity, or do they like the fact that it's kind of murky and if they're not really thrilled about giving out the records, they've got this excuse that, well, we didn't know.
Yeah. I mean, I think that governments sometimes do like it to be murky. I don't think that's because they're bad people or something like that. It's just nobody wants to get sued, right? And so – you know, Governor Cooper's in office now. He used to be the champion of public records law. I wonder if he still would be now, you know, now that he's the governor and people are going to be coming after him. The murkiness factor, though, I've met a lot of people from local governments, at least, who don't like that because unpredictability isn't necessarily good for them. Unpredictability can be bad for everybody. So to that extent, I would say that maybe people in government don't necessarily like the murkiness factor.
Well, one person who's going to be watching as this hopefully becomes a little less murky in the years ahead is Elliot Engstrom. He is a fellow at the Elon University School of Law. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Full color throughout every issue. More visual storytelling. We've revamped Carolina Journal to make it easier to read. A new look and a new feel. But one thing hasn't changed, and it never will. That is our commitment to truth and transparency in government. You can still count on Carolina Journal for investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, and vetting of corruption. Now, our mission to shine the light on what North Carolina government and the bureaucrats who run it are doing in your name and with your money will never wane. And because of that, our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our distribution outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians every month. So make sure you stay informed. Read the monthly print edition of Carolina Journal. Then check in several times a day at carolinajournal.com. That's where you'll find fresh stories, opinion pieces, and updates on government, politics, and your money. Carolina Journal, we hold government accountable to you. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Why thieves might want stricter licensing rules for security guards. That is the striking headline from a recent piece about the research into whether the public is safer when security guards are required to be licensed by the state. Now, you might think that more rules about who can work as a guard equates to more safety, but here to explain why this may not be the case is John Sanders. He's director of regulatory studies for the John Locke Foundation, and he wrote this piece that I've referenced. John, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Donna.
Some people might say, but common sense tells you the more hoops that you have someone jump through before they can get a job, a very important job as a security guard, that means we're going to get better quality people. You say maybe not so.
Well, it's very well possible that we are getting better quality people, but we're not getting as many. The more that you raise the price, and the price in terms of time, cost, and dealing with hassles, et cetera, not just necessarily a monetary price of doing anything, the less you're going to get of it. So the more strict you make it to get a license to get to be a security guard, the fewer security guards they're going to be. And what this research found, this was from the Archbridge Institute, was that the more strict the licensing for security guards were, the fewer there were security guard firms, and as a result, the more property crimes those states had.
Now, that's really fascinating. Why more property crimes?
There weren't as many people to keep property safe.
It's that simple,
yeah.
Really. The fewer guards, then more property is open to be taken by thieves. Does North Carolina actually require this type of licensing?
Yeah, we have a security guard and patrol license.
And that's just one of a whole lot. Give us a sense of some of the job categories or occupations, John, that people may not realize require a specific license and sometimes all sorts of testing and fees attached in order to work in the field.
Yeah, there are, for example, there are 13 different licenses for lower income occupations that North Carolina has that fewer than half the states have. And one that I was thinking of in particular would be like sign language interpreters. And you can see a reason for that. You want your sign language interpreter to be able to interpret sign language. But North Carolina not only requires a license, which we're one of only 22 states that does it, but also among the states to do it, our fees are about $300 more, and they require at least about a year of schooling more than the other licensing states. And that's one example.
And people may not realize that you're talking about not only sometimes having to go sit through particular courses and pass tests, but money. Give us a sense of about how much money does it cost to get a license in some of these fields?
It can get quite expensive. It depends. It's a wide variety in fields. There are a lot of construction trades in North Carolina that are licensed that half the states don't really bother doing licensing for them. But regarding them, North Carolina's fees for those are not near as expensive as other licensing. So, it balances out in some ways.
And some of these can run hundreds of dollars for
yes,
people to be able
yes.
to actually just receive the permit, even once they pass all the necessary schooling and testing and all that. John, in your writing on this subject over the past few years, you have made a pretty consistent argument, and that is that workers should be subjected to the least amount of regulation and rules and hoops, so to speak, as possible. Why?
Necessary for the job. And one of the main reasons why is the North Carolina Constitution. North Carolina protects a right for people to enjoy the fruits of their own labor. That is one of the self-evident rights that is enshrined in the North Carolina Constitution. We see not only the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness that were guaranteed, that were attested to in the Declaration of Independence. We put it in our Constitution, and then we added the rights to enjoy the fruit of their labor. So I think that is a very strong case for protecting people's right to work, to earn a living. So that's one of the main reasons I come at it. Another is the research is clear that more licensing leads to less opportunities for people, higher prices for consumers, and that's just not what we need.
And speaking of fewer opportunities, another fascinating piece of research that you've been writing about is data coming from the National Employment Law Project. And this organization was looking at folks who have some sort of arrest record or criminal conviction, and they have paid their dues to society, so to speak, and they're trying to re-enter society and get a job. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that was a very good study. And I think one of the most interesting factoids that come from it is, first of all, people re-entering society from prison, most of them are not going back to prison. I mean, we do worry about recidivism rates, but it's still fewer than half the people who get out of jail are going back in. So they have been rehabilitated in the terms that we like to think of. They want to get out and work. But it's very difficult if you're in a state like North Carolina that has a lot of disqualifications to get a license for any kind of conviction record. Some states, about 25 states, have things written in their law that say essentially that the conviction has to be applicable to the license. So, for example, you wouldn't want an accountant to be in jail for writing fraudulent checks. You wouldn't want a tow truck driver to be a drunk driver.
Right.
So things like that. I mean, that would definitely get to the safety issue that the licensing is supposed to address. But if you've got someone who was, made some foolish choices as a teenager, to be impacted the rest of his life from it is not something I think we should want as a society.
And you noted that out of this data that was released by the National Employment Law Project, they looked specifically at North Carolina, and they said that, for example, 641 separate disqualifications in the state's occupational licensing laws. Help us understand what a disqualification is.
The disqualification means that if you have a conviction record, you cannot get this particular license. So it's not like you're applying for a job with somebody and the employer that you're applying to decides they don't want to take a chance on you because you have a conviction record. You still have a chance with somebody else in that case, or worst comes to worst, you could go into business for yourself. But with state licensing, without the license, you can't have the job. So without a license, all of the employers, including yourself, all of your potential employers, will not be able to hire you to work in this state in that field.
And that report actually also notes that North Carolina has the 11th most disqualifications in the country and the second in the Southeast. So, John, as we move forward and next year when the state legislature comes back into session, this issue tends to come up. There tends to be some discussion about taking a look at the state's licensing regime. What's your recommendation to them?
I would recommend something like what Texas has with regard to the criminal ordinance, to make sure that any criminal disqualification for a conviction record be stated directly and linked directly to the licensing provision. And I would continue to promote getting rid of as much licensing as possible and leaving it only for the most extreme safety examples that we have.
John Sanders is the Director of Regulatory Studies for the John Locke Foundation. You can read both of the pieces that he's written that we've discussed in this interview at johnlocke.org. John, thanks very much.
Thank you, Donna.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Gokai, I'm Donna Martinez. We hope you'll come back again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.